This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Plum Kettle is 300 pounds and has been on a diet for her whole life. She's waiting to be thin in order to begin her real life, and consequently planning to get a very expensive weight loss surgery. She has a whole wardrobe waiting for her new self, who she's named Alicia. Instead, Plum is sought out by a group of radical feminists who bring her into their fold, where she learns to stop hating fat and to get angry at men and at patriarchy instead of herself. This story is from a new radical feminist novel called Dietland. I spoke with the author, Saray Walker, about fat activism, feminist revolution, and fuckability over the phone last week. Here is that interview. First, I wonder if you can talk about why fat is such a political issue, particularly when it comes to women.
Well, I think the female body is always politicized, and so this is just one part of that. And if you look back, for example, at the 20th century, and now this isn't my research, this is stuff I've read from historians and scholars, but if you look back at the 20th century, you can see at times when women gained more power, a thin ideal came in. So, for example, in the 1920s, women in many countries got the right to vote. There was sort of a burgeoning feminist movement. Women had more independence in some ways, more access to education. And at the same time, this thin ideal came in, right? Epitomized by the flapper and very thin, kind of boyish figure. Women would bind their breasts and also cut their hair short. So there was this kind of radical change in what the beauty ideal of the day was. And we see that happen again at other points in history. So if you look, for example, during World War II, women gained a bit more independence, working in factories and supporting the war effort. And then in the 50s, there was this push to get women back into the home. And at that time, a heavier ideal came in, right? A more matronly, kind of motherly body. And the sex symbols of that era, like Marilyn Monroe or Jane Mansfield, sort of symbolize that. I mean, they obviously have the ideal hourglass shape, but still a little bit of a bigger body came in. Mm. And then in the 60s, when second wave feminism started to, flourish, what happened again? We have Twiggy and this very thin ideal again. And it started again, the thin ideal, I would say in the mid to late 60s, and it just hasn't stopped since then. It's gotten worse and worse and worse. So I think when women take up more space in society in a kind of metaphorical way, so have a louder voice or enter, male-dominated areas, then at the other side of this, it's like there's more pressure for women to take up less physical space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, so we see that. So I think that, there's all sorts, fat is a very political issue, and there's all sorts of intersecting issues, gender and race and class and all these ideas about health. But just looking at it through a strictly feminist lens, I think that that's an interesting pattern to look at.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to point out to listeners that you choose to use the word fat as opposed to like all those other words that are sort of recently popular and intended to be politically correct, I suppose, like curvy and things like that. Maybe can you explain why you choose to use the word fat?
Yeah, so, fat activists use the word fat. And, whereas most other people use euphemisms, there's the O words, right, overweight and obese. Those words have problems, right? So overweight sort of implies that there's an ideal weight. Mm. obese is really this term invented by the medical community to turn fatness into a disease and to sort of speak of all fat people as this group, you know, the obese. So they're kind of these dehumanizing words. And then, you know, there's curvy and chubby and heavy and large. But, you know, it's a lot of it's just trying to avoid saying the word fat. And so why not just say it? You know, it's not inherently bad. It's only bad because we put these negative connotations on it. And so it's kind of, when you kind of reclaim this word, it's kind of fun because it's an F word and it really freaks people out when you say it. So,
and your book points out through the protagonist, Plum, that as a fat woman, she sees the worst in other humans, and men in particular, because of her body and because of how she's treated, because of her weight. So she says in the book, because I'm fat, I know how horrible everyone is, which is really awful, but it's also really, you know, it's really telling. I mean, that's true. And that's probably something that doesn't occur to a lot of people who aren't viewed as fat in our society. Like, is this kind of based on personal experience? And I wonder also if you can explain why you think other humans, men in particular, are so horrible to women who aren't thin.
Yeah, so, you know, in Dietland, I write a lot about fuckability. And there's a character in the novel, Marlo, who was an actress and a model, and then she got fired from her sitcom for cutting her hair and gaining weight. They basically told her, you know, she needed to become more fuckable or her career in Hollywood was over. And so she ended up writing this feminist theory book called Fuckability Theory. And so that theory sort of permeates the novel, I think. So I kind of play around with that a lot. The novel is really about, you know, the construction of the ideal feminine body, and that it very much is a social construction. And that if you're fat, you don't fit into that, right? So as I talked about a few minutes ago, the thin ideal has been in for decades now. So if you don't fit the thin ideal, your body is viewed as, you know, undisciplined and uncontrolled. And since there's so much pressure on women to adhere to certain ideals of beauty, and what I call fuckability, you know, it's not just thinness, I wouldn't say. It's also, you know, this kind of hotness, right? Kind of what Ariel Levy wrote about in Female Chauvinist Pigs. So there's more to it than just thinness, but being thin is definitely a prerequisite for being hot in our culture. And so if you don't fit into that, if you're not the idealized woman, then you're basically considered to be unfuckable. And since to many men, you know, women's primary purpose is to be a fuckable object, then women who are considered unfuckable are basically worthless, right? They don't have any value. It's like, mm-hmm. Well, why do you exist? Mm-hmm. You know, I get that when I'm in the public eye sometimes, I'll have men write me that are basically kind of outraged that I would dare to go into the public eye or that I dare even exist. I talked to women and I also did research about women who had lost a lot of weight. So, right. So women who had lost a lot of weight through dieting, women who had weight loss surgery and lost a lot of weight very quickly, or even actresses that had put on a fat suit for a part and then gone out in public. And they all talk about how they are treated when they're fat drastically different than when they are thin, often by men, not always, you know, women too, but, you know, especially by men. And that this, for these women, was a very unsettling experience, that it was depressing, and demoralizing, and it really altered their worldview to see how, you know, they're the same person and were treated very differently depending on their body size. Mm. So, you know, I read a lot of those stories and heard stories from friends and people, and that I definitely wanted to write about that in the book, that, you know, what you look like is, you know, particularly as a woman, since our appearance is so tied to our worth, that what you look like really influences how people treat you and then influences your worldview in a way that people who adhere more to an ideal kind of norm maybe don't see or don't know about.
Mm-hmm. So do you see the way that fat people are treated in society as a form of discrimination?
Yeah, it's definitely a form of discrimination. And, you know, there have been studies showing how fat people are discriminated against in the workplace, in housing, in the healthcare industry. And I'm not sure about the laws in Canada, but here there's only, I think, 2 or 3 places that outlaw discrimination against fat people. So discrimination is widespread, but there's basically no legal protection at all. And then there's the other, you know, the other things, the bullying, the abuse, the marginalization, you know, the internalized fat shame. And this has been shown to really affect the quality of life of fat people, not surprisingly. And again, part of that, what you were just talking about, plays into it as, well, it must be my fault, right? You know, you internalize it. Instead mm-hmm. of, you know, instead of recognizing that an injustice is being tended to you, it's like, well, I deserve it. You know, it's my fault. So it's very difficult to be a fat person. And, you know, the fatter you are, the worse that it gets.
Mm-hmm. And you said in an article that I was reading about you that London specifically was one of the most fat-blaming, because you lived in London for a while, right?
Yeah, I did my PhD there.
Yeah. So, and you said that was one of the most fat-shaming places you've ever experienced. Why is that? I mean, how so?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's, you know, I've lived in the Western U.S. I lived in New York and Boston. I've lived in France. So I have lived, you know, a few places at least. And, you know, living in London, I lived there for about 6 or 7 years, was definitely the most overtly fat-shaming place I've ever been, by far, without question. And I actually talked to somebody else who had moved from the States over there, another fat activist, who said she experienced the same thing. You know, so it kind of made me feel like, okay, I'm not imagining this. First of all, the media there, the kind of tabloid media is really nasty. And I think, you know, in the States, we don't really have an equivalent to that kind of tabloid press. And I don't know if you do in Canada, but, so their tabloid press is very vicious and very misogynist. So maybe that drives some of it, but, you know, it's like in public, I would have men come up to me saying, you should go on a diet, or just critiquing my appearance. I think, you know, feeling totally entitled to come up to me and say things like this. Mm. And I had never really experienced, you know, of course, any fat person gets abused, but I had never experienced it like that ever. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, I've tried to think why that would be, because British people, you know, are known for being very polite and, you know, friendly people. And, you know, and that's true. It certainly wasn't everybody. But I began to wonder if, you know, one of the other things in London is that there were these overtly sexualized images of women everywhere. You know, there was, you know, naked women in newspapers and the red phone booths filled with all of these little cards with naked women. And the corner shop would have these lads magazines that were much more graphic than the ones we have here. And also like hardcore porn, you would see like at eye level in a little corner market. And it was everywhere. It was very strange to me. And so, yeah, I wasn't sure if that was part of it. It was sort of like, there was these images, these overtly sexualized images of women all over the place. And so again, someone deemed unfuckable was really subject to an attack. Mm-hmm. And maybe felt like, you know, women's bodies are maybe public property and in a more extreme way. Because all these things happen in other societies, but I just felt it was much more extreme there. Mm-hmm. But I don't fully understand why, but that was my theory.
Mm-hmm. And what's been the response to your book? Have you received or experienced any pushback?
So my hardcover, you know, release came out almost a year ago. And then the British publication was last week. And then the US-Canadian paperback's coming out in a couple of weeks. So I've been doing this for about a year now. And it's been difficult. I mean, there's been sort of extremes. I would say that I've really connected with readers who just love the book. You know, women who are desperate to see themselves represented in literature, or who are just kind of thrilled by a feminist novel, because there are not really any overtly feminist novels like this. There were in the 70s and the 80s, but there isn't really a lot of overt feminist fiction. So, you know, a lot of women love it because of that. And so I have, you know, some great responses on that side of people who love it. But then on the other side, from people, mostly people who haven't read it, right? So when I do interviews about fat and that sort of thing, then I get lots of backlash from that. And, you know, it's been hard. You know, I've realized that it takes tremendous courage to speak publicly about fat in a positive way, particularly if you're a fat woman. And I don't think I was prepared for that, you know, for the just hatred that exists, and being the kind of target of that, you know, in a more public way. And it's been very difficult. I've had moments where just feeling very, you know, demoralized and depressed, and like I just wanted to hide and never talk to anyone again. Mm. So very mixed. I would say like different extremes. So it's been sort of a roller coaster in that way.
Mm-hmm. And I read it, like I said, I read an article about you and the book in The Guardian. I think that was the same place that I read about your experience in London. And that same article mentioned that during an interview on an Australian radio show, the novelist Will Self said that, or told you, that humans are evolutionarily programmed to find fat people ugly. How do you respond to these kinds of comments?
Yes, that was an interesting interview. I think, well, and it was, you know, on live on the radio, and I had no idea it was going to happen. So it was, you know, my Australian book tour was quite interesting in that way. But, you know, anytime you say anything positive about fat, people will react. I call it fat derangement syndrome. So they react right away. They just become outraged. And usually they go for the health argument, you know, oh, being fat's unhealthy. And Will Self did that as well in the interview, but he also mentioned attractiveness, which a lot of people don't do because they don't want to seem like they're being, you know, focused on appearance. They just want to stick with health, which is, seems to them to be more respectable reason to object to fat acceptance. Mm. But he was talking about, yeah, that basically the gist of it was that we're sort of programmed to find fat people unattractive, which is actually, you know, that's something that's easy to respond to because it's absolutely untrue. I mean, you can look at history and, you know, the types of bodies that are considered the ideal or that are valued the most shift throughout time and also shift depending on culture. So there are, you know, there are countries and cultures now that value fatter bodies more than thinner ones. So that's something that's just absolutely untrue. But, you know, people believe that. They think that we're just programmed to prefer thinness, and it's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. In one section of your book that I really enjoyed, you're talking about women eating unapologetically. And so you write, in Verena's house, which is where Plum's living with some other feminist women, there was never any mention of calories. There was no, I shouldn't eat this, I shouldn't eat that. Plates were scraped clean. Oohs and ahs were abundant. Women asked for more. No prayers were offered up to the diet gods. I'll go to the gym later. I didn't eat dinner last night. There was pleasure that didn't have to be bargained for. And you also talk about women being unafraid to take up space, and I know you mentioned that a little bit earlier. Do you think that for women, fat and eating unapologetically can be a radical act?
Well, I think, you know, if you're a fat woman and you say, I accept myself, I love my fat body, fat is beautiful, that is extremely radical. I mean, I've experienced that over the past year. People just lose it and just freak out. It's really a taboo to say that you think it's okay to be fat or that fat is beautiful. Is one of, you know, it's a lasting taboo. It's interesting. So that is certainly radical. I think, you know, I think for any woman, loving your body can be a radical act. But, you know, of course, if you're fat, even more so. So definitely on that. And I think with eating, you know, I think for women of any size, you know, women are so often policed in what we eat. And I think that, you know, if you're a woman and to kind of cut out the diet talk and play, you know, to stop placing moral value on food and this kind of bargaining, like, well, you know, I'll have dessert because I didn't eat breakfast. And, you know, kind of stopping all of that can be very liberating and radical. So there's a lot of radical potential, I think, in all of this.
Mm-hmm. And you made another point that was quite interesting and poignant in an article that you wrote for the New York Times about the word fat and why you use it and how afraid others are of the word. And so you wrote, Americans are obsessed with obesity, yet actual fat people are largely absent from our culture landscape, which is totally true. And again, something that I hadn't really thought about that much personally. Why do you think that fat people are limited to being basically, you know, comedic relief, or it seems like kind of like a fear-mongering tactic in the media?
Well, I think, you know, fat people as a group are dehumanized. And as I've experienced myself being more in the public eye, that there's a complete lack of empathy for fat people in society in general. And so I think, you know, when you have a group of people that's so hated, then, you know, they're not going to be represented in a positive way in the media or in pop culture. But I think that there are certain ways that fat people can be visible. There are certain acceptable ways. So, for example, you know, these headless fat bodies, right? You know, these kind of, you know, these bodies where you cut off the head, these pictures. And so basically showing that all fat people are just sort of interchangeable, right? They're just this mass called the obese. So we see those kind of images, and we see shows, you know, for example, The Biggest Loser, or we see dieting commercials or celebrities like Oprah, who are sort of in the public eye, but they're always, you know, framing their fatness as a failure and that they want to become thin. Right. So that's acceptable. If you want to be in the public eye and berate yourself for being fat and aspire to thinness, that's okay. You know, they'll public will allow that. Or in films, for example, you know, Melissa McCarthy, who is, you know, a big movie star. She's had a string of hit movies, but there are very limited types of roles that she plays, you know, the clown, you know, or some kind of vulgar, you know, loudmouth character. You don't see Melissa McCarthy as a lead in a romantic comedy or in a costume drama. You know, we see her in these parts, which I'm sure is all she gets offered, that are very narrow parts. So there are certain ways that fat people can be in public, and that's considered acceptable. But if you depart from that, and I think that's what I've experienced a bit with my book. I mean, my book is fat positive, and there are very, very few things in society that are fat positive. Mm-hmm. And also in interviews saying, you know, it's okay to be fat and fat can be beautiful. If you go off script of what we're supposed to say about fat, then people become outraged, mm-hmm. Which I've experienced, you know, firsthand, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the most thrilling aspects of Dietland, which I loved, is the revenge that was enacted on poor, like, men who watch porn, rapists, general misogynists, men who objectify women for a living, you know, men who run porn companies or sexist magazines, etc., men who oppose reproductive rights, via this terrorist group named Jennifer, who's acts start turning women across the world into angry radicals too, which is really amazing. And so certainly, like, that idea of, you know, terrorizing misogynists in this way is enticing, particularly as you framed it, which is as a response to that lifelong terrorism faced by women living in a patriarchy. I wonder if you can talk about, like, you know, feminist revolution. Do you think this kind of revolution is realistic? I know, you know, it's obviously a fantasy and there's obviously some stuff that's very tongue in cheek, but considering what women are subjected to, what is your perspective on feminist revolution?
Well, you know, in Dietland, I wanted to explore different modes of resistance, right? So there's Plum's, her sort of individual resistance, and then there's women, you know, their collective resistance through more traditional activism. And then there's this violent resistance in the form of Jennifer. And it was very difficult to imagine what a violent, you know, resistance would look like, because there aren't really many examples of it. You know, I think some of the suffragists in England use some violence. Of course, nothing like what Jennifer does. There's a group in India, the Pink Sari Gang, that do engage in vigilantism against abusive men. But, you know, they also do lots of organizing and activism. So there's really, I've never seen anything like this, a group, you know, a feminist terrorist group engaging in this kind of violence. So I have a hard time even imagining, you know, what would they do? Who would they target? How would people respond? Would it work? I really had to kind of make it up because, you know, I didn't know what it would really look like. And I kind of wanted the reader to, you know, to think, what does she think of it? Because I get so many letters from women saying, well, I feel really bad, but I just love those parts. You know, I know I shouldn't admit it, but I love it. And I kind of fantasize about something like that happening. But, you know, I'm not sure if something like that would work, given the way that sexism is, you know, given it's these cultural attitudes, and I don't know how you could eradicate those through violence, right? And I know that violence is really opposed to what feminism is all about. So, and it would just probably, you know, which, as in the book, it just would just cause more violence towards women. And so, you know, I don't think that would work in real life, but I think it's important to sort of think about that and fantasize about it a little bit. And so I think that that's one of the things that fiction can do that nonfiction really doesn't do, is it can allow for these kind of imaginative scenarios. Like, what if there was a feminist holding society hostage and making them take the objectifying images of women and replace them with men? What would happen? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, by imagining that, it can help us think more critically about these issues, at least.
I also love that in the book you acknowledge what you describe as the trauma of becoming a woman. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, throughout the book, I write about the construction of normative femininity, particularly of the body. And so I think that, you know, as Simone de Beauvoir famously wrote, one isn't born a woman, one becomes one. And I think that that process can be traumatizing. You know, I think in the context in the book where that line comes up, they're specifically talking about teen girls, right? So I think, you know, before adolescence, when you're just a child, you do have this freedom that maybe you never really have again. And, you know, of course, since birth, we're all programmed to act a certain way based on male or female. But I think as a little kid, there's still just a bit more freedom, a freedom of your body, freedom to run around and do what you want and get dirty and whatever, you know. And then when you start to go through puberty, I think it's this acknowledgement that you're all of a sudden realizing the limitations of being a woman, that your body starts to change and you start to get this, you start to be viewed as a more sexual object. And, you know, wondering if you adhere to, you know, these standards and whether you're an appropriate object for the male gaze and these sorts of things. But also just facing the limitations that women have in our lives and the restrictions that we have. And so I think that that's a difficult time. And I think, you know, there's research to suggest that girls do become, you know, can become depressed, and demoralized in that time. And it can be traumatic, I think. So that's just kind of what I was getting at there.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you think that there are ways the feminist movement has addressed the issue of fat and of women's bodies in general that has been productive, and then also if there's ways that it's failed and in ways that the feminist movement could sort of improve in terms of addressing that issue of fat and women.
Well, you know, fat activism has always been part of feminism. I would say, you know, in 1970, there was the Fat Underground, this radical fat activist group that was formed. So, you know, that was around the time that second wave feminism was also, you know, beginning to flourish. So I think that fat activists have always kind of been part of feminism. But I do think that there are, you know, some troubling attitudes towards fat within feminism. For example, you know, books like Fat is a Feminist Issue. You know, there's some feminist books, especially during that time period, I guess in the 80s and 90s, that sort of framed fat as in a more pathological way, so that a fat body wasn't just fat. It was because of you're fat because of some sort of psychological problem or trauma.
Hmm.
And so it wasn't just Susie Orbach that wrote about that. There are other feminist writers who did. But I think that that became a common way of thinking about fat. And also this idea that maybe fat is the opposite of anorexia, you know, that you have on one extreme, you know, people not eating. And then there was assumed that at the other end of the, you know, extreme, you have fat people who are just eating constantly, which is just not, that's not what, you know, fat is not the opposite of anorexia. Sure, there are people of any size who have eating disorders, you know, fat people, thin people, whatever. But being fat in and of itself is not evidence of having an eating disorder. And there are plenty of fat people that don't have eating disorders, just like there are plenty of thin people who don't. So I think that idea of thinking as fat is somehow connected to anorexia, that these, you know, these kind of ideas have been certainly problematic. But I think that in the past decade or so, where fat activism has really started this kind of, you know, activism and this new way of thinking, I think it is influencing feminism in a positive way, some of these more troublesome, you know, ideas. So I think that's a good thing. But I think, you know, there's still a long way to go. I think that women in general don't want to be fat, right? I mean, I think that there are thin women who are allies of fat acceptance, but that they themselves would never want to be fat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's important to examine those kinds of attitudes as well if you're a feminist.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess along those lines, what do you think about, you know, there's sort of been, there have been more plus size models is what they call them. There's been more fat women in the fashion world and some women who I don't really know that anybody would call fat, but they're described as plus size. They're not, you know, the normal size that models are, which is, I don't know, 90 pounds or something like that. But this is seen by a lot of people as a positive shift in terms of representation of more diverse bodies, I guess some people would call that. I wonder if you can talk about that. I mean, do you think that's productive at all?
I saw something pop up on Twitter today, actually, that was saying that somebody did an analysis of actually how many plus size models there actually are in these magazines, and it's still very, very, very small. But I think, you know, yeah, plus size models are basically the size of the average woman. Mm-hmm. But of course, yeah, compared to a size zero, they look enormous. And, you know, I think, you know, on the one hand, okay, you know, it's better to have, some, you know, plus size models and then not have any, but I think that they just, I think that there's a way for the fashion industry and women's magazines to sort of co-opt, some of fat activism or body positivity and say, okay, you know, here we'll have a few, you know, token plus size models, but of course they all have the idealized hourglass figure and they'll never be above, you know, usually a size 14 or 16. Mm. And so there's this, you know, they kind of throw a few scraps, I guess, but it's not really, you know, real change. And you have women like Ashley Graham, who's, you know, on the cover of Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue and in Maxim and all these magazines. But, you know, I don't know how that's helping the average fat woman because, again, she's this very, you know, perfect figure. And, you know, she doesn't look, she doesn't really reflect what the average fat woman looks like. And it's just, so I don't really know how much that is actually helping. I mean, I don't think fashion magazines and the fashion industry are allies to look to help change our attitudes about the body.
Yeah, exactly. And so finally, you know, what's next for you? My understanding is that Dietland is going to be turned into a TV series.
Yes, it's been optioned as a TV series, which is really exciting. And it's basically, the plan is at this point that it would be more like a limited series, so like a mini series rather than a series that goes on and on year after year. So we're just kind of getting started on that. And I'll be a consultant on it. So, you know, I don't really know much about this process at all. So I'm really excited to learn, you know, what it's like and what's going to happen. And the woman who optioned it, Marty Noxon, she has a really great vision for it. And she loves Dietland precisely because it challenges these norms and is radical and defiant. So I'm really hopeful that this could be, you know, that the Dietland TV show could be something like we've never seen on TV before. So it's exciting. You know, it's an exciting thought.
Mm-hmm, totally. Well, congratulations on your success. The book is amazing. I've never read anything like it, and it's so well written and interesting and insightful and really exciting and radical in a really exciting way that, of course, we don't get to experience all that much as feminists.
Well, thank you.
You just heard an interview with Saray Walker, author of Dietland. The paperback is out in North America on May 24th. For more on her work, visit saraiwalker.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.